We've got a time for question and answer. I need someone to take this microphone for me. And we're trying to record these, and if you have a question, we'd like you to speak into the microphone. Does anyone have a question? Gentleman over here. So one of you is armed with a mic and one's not, or you take it off, or you still got the mic on? Yeah, okay.
Mr. Pratt, will you address the objection that signing up with Gun Owners of America might be considered a form of registration when the government nabs your list?
Well, if anybody...
you're still hot, okay.
If anybody thinks that the government's going to get our names, they are mistaken. First of all, there's happily a good legal precedent from years ago when the government tried to get the names of the members of the NAACP in Alabama, and U.S. Alabama versus NAACP went to the Supreme Court, and those lists were held privately. The court said you can't get at them. There have been other attempts, and that legal tradition has continued. That having been said, one of the attempts to go after lists was with some of our allies over at the Right to Work Committee. And there were days, I know, when Reed Larson had his bag packed. And if it comes to it, I'll do the same thing. That list is not going voluntarily anywhere but through our own computer, which is not online with anybody. Now, the other thing you might consider is that at some point, you need to take a stand and you need to be organized, because if we're not united and working together, they're going to get us singly. What was it that Ben Franklin said? We're either going to hang together or hang separately. And so at that point, they all signed the Declaration of Independence. Now, admittedly, some of them are a little hard to read. But John Hancock, you remember, that's how we still have that in our language. Put your John Hancock there. And that's why. I mean, there were a number of those men, knowing they were signing their death certificate if that war went wrong, signed very plainly. But I'm not trying to say I'm wishing martyrdom on you. We're doing everything we can to protect our list.
This message or this question would be for either Brother Larry or Brother Steve. Ron Castle, a member of our church, asked a question 2 weeks ago, and it kind of sparked some debate in our congregation, good lively debate. And I'm going to try to put the question as eloquently as Ron did. And this is going to be somewhat hypothetical, and I want to kind of draw it out into two different scenarios. Kidnapping is a crime punishable by death according to the law of God. Suppose a government official was going to come into your home and take your children away. One, let's say that it was possibly a report that you were abusing the child, which was untrue, or two, they were going to take your child away because you were teaching them Christianity, which they considered to be revolutionary. What type of force as an individual private citizen would you be allowed to use to stop them from doing that?
Steve has graciously allowed me to answer this question. I would use whatever force I had to use to flee. And I've helped families leave the state of Virginia in the early days of homeschooling when they were about to lose their kids on truancy charges. And before the charges actually got filed, before the actual proceeding in court, so there was technically no action against them, we saw what was coming and they just got out of Dodge. And if somebody had tried to impede their flight, well, yeah. But anyway, you try to flee.
I guess the question ultimately comes is, at what point can you, as a Christian, before the eyes of God, use that type of force, though you're not a civil magistrate, to stop? I mean, what are your forces of action to be able to take? And it's not that Ron or I want to go around shooting government officials.
Thank you.
the question that I've been asked is, well, you know, how do you, what if you had no other option but to use force, would you do that? If there's no magistrate around to defend you, that more or less sum up the question. Let's look at it historically. When our forefathers came to the point where they began to see that they might have to fight the tyrant, the beast in London, there was so much community support for that. It certainly wasn't unanimous, by no means. There was enough community support for that that there were municipal armories. In fact, one of the things that got things precipitated was, starting in September of 1774, General Gage began to try his best to steal the contents of those magazines and those repositories of the ball that might be used in the guns. And it was basically when he gave such a convincing argument that he wanted to enslave them, that he was going to continue trying to take the guns, that things got started. But that was in the context of a considerable community support. If you're going to be the Lone Ranger and you're going to use lethal force, say, to get those homeschoolers out of a nasty jurisdiction, consider that you're resigning yourself to live as a fugitive for the rest of your life. And the difference between that and being in jail may be a difference without a distinction, or a distinction without a real difference. I think at that point you're really up to your conscience, but in my opinion, there comes a point where you can't go any farther as an individual. The tyranny of the time and the curse of the age may be so severe that you don't want to make the problem worse by becoming lawless. And I was telling somebody earlier privately that some of the people that have been engaged in militia activity, were they to ever rule in this country, it would probably be worse than the characters we got right now. So, I know that our forefathers were extremely concerned to consider that their armed resistance be seen by their own population and the rest of the world as legitimate resistance to a thug beating up on a little kid, sort of thing. You know, real clear, bright line distinction. And we're in such a godless time that some situations that you could easily point to, like the one we've been discussing, wouldn't resonate. So probably the thing that we've got to do is flee before we flee. Keep your head down. I mean, I talk to so many parents of little children now, and they're constantly thinking of ways to avoid public discipline of the child, because they know what's likely to happen. They'll get somebody to drop a dime on them. And so instead of just saying, well, I've got my rights, I can go, you know, do what I want, and they see what they're going to do, get my gun from my cold dead fingers, sort of thing. Well, the guy that says that probably will have it taken from his cold dead fingers. No, not even that. He'll hand it over like this, because he's not doing anything right now to change the system. So if he's not doing anything now, I don't see any fight coming from him. So I don't want to get involved in Lone Ranger situations. I want to do everything I can to avoid those. Flight's the first line of biblical defense.
Pastor Wilkins, are you going to vote in November, sir?
Yes. No, I'm going to vote for Howard Phillips.
Okay. Pros and cons of gun permits.
I think it was mentioned just a minute ago, where jurisdictions have made it easier for people to do what they should be able to do without a permit, but where the permit system has been liberalized, you find crime going down. And the longer the law is on the books, the more the crime goes down. Gun Owners of America worked in Virginia to convert the very arbitrary system where judges frequently in urban areas did not allow permits. Ali North could prove that he had a contract from Abu Nidal on his life, and they still wouldn't give him a permit to carry in Fairfax County. We worked to get it made to a shall issue system, and the number of people that at least we know are carrying, I'm sure there are others that may not have a permit, but the ones that we know, it's mushrooms. And Virginia's murder rate continues to head down. What we have pushed for in a number of states where we thought we had the horses to make a spirited fight, knowing that we're probably not going to win first time out. By the way, Brady took 13 years before they finally succeeded, and they weren't worried about losing in the first year and the second year, and they just kept coming back, and I think we can learn something good from that particular example. And so in a number of states, we've begun legislative battles to try to set us on that road toward Vermont, where you can carry a firearm with no restriction whatsoever. It's a matter of true right in the state of Vermont. The government has nothing to say about it. But we want more and more people using, carrying guns. We want to get guns on the street as much as handgun control wants to get them off the street.
Larry, what can we do to join Gun Owners of America for the folks that are here if they would like to join? Do you have any information in that regard?
We're on that literature table over in the cafeteria. And
thank
there's
you.
A coupon in there. You can fill it out, send it in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve.
Wow.
I'm going to put it down here. Can you give us just a... it seems to me that there was quite a bit of debate in the Constitutional Convention over the representation of states and how they were represented, and kind of came up with a compromise with the House of Representatives and the Senate. Can you outline for us some of the debates and the discussion of who was represented, how they were represented, and why that distinction in between the House of Representatives and the states, and also how the Electoral College fits into that? Because there's a lot of discussion right now about abandoning the Electoral College.
Yeah, that was a big debate. Of course, the big states wanted equal representation. I'm sorry, wanted proportionate representation because they had a higher population. The small states wanted equal representation. So what they did is they compromised and had two houses. One where every state would have equal representation, which would be the Senate. One where there would be proportionate representation, which is the House. The Electoral College was based on that proportionate representation, and I haven't done the work to absolutely document this, but it seems clear from the way it was set up that originally it was never intended to be a winner-take-all of electoral votes. In other words, you would have two votes that the state would present for a particular candidate, and then the rest of the state could vote, and it seems clear that each district would then choose its own candidate, so that it wouldn't be unusual. In fact, it wasn't in the early years that a state would vote for two or three candidates, splitting up its electoral votes accordingly, where you would get two, like the one who won the majority would get the two statewide votes. And then the rest of the candidates would get votes according to the proportion, according to whether they won in a particular district or not. Now, that's a very important provision if we could go back to doing that. I'm not sure that every state had it set up like that. I believe South Carolina did, though, proportionate representation and giving their electoral votes according to how the district voted. What that means is that big cities do not have the overwhelming power they have now under this present situation, where the majority vote, whoever wins the majority vote, automatically gets all the electoral votes of that state. That's undermining the Electoral College, and that's why people don't think that it's worth anything. Now, that's why the people always are going to say it again, what use is it? It's no good. Well, the idea was a very good one, because it was the idea was a president ought to be a true representative of the people, of the state and the people, so that you would have a man who had very wide support. Nowadays, all he has to do, I'm sure it's the same here in Tennessee as it is in Louisiana. In Louisiana, they go to two cities, if at all. If they come to Louisiana, they go to New Orleans. The only reason they'll never come, unless it's Howard Phillips or somebody, or Pat Buchanan, will come to Monroe. They'll never do that, unless they just need the vote so desperately they feel like they can pick up a few. But they know if they can carry New Orleans and carry Shreveport, it doesn't matter how Monroe votes. It doesn't matter how the rest of the state votes. You can get such a wide majority in big cities that you can overcome losing everywhere else in the state. And that's what you have now is this, what I call the citification of politics. Every big city issue is a national issue. You know, the homeless problem. We don't have a homeless problem. Most cities don't have a homeless problem. New York has a homeless problem. New Orleans does too.
Do the alligators take care of your
problem? Yeah, man. They won't let us shoot them, so they get the alligators get their great meals. Yeah, I don't know if I finished, but anyway, that's basically it. It's a real good idea. Don't let anybody do away with the Electoral College. Let's just go back to what we should have done from the beginning and have it that way. That's a great idea. Then each state would vote for a number of candidates.
No, you said it, but to emphasize what Steve was saying, the Senate is the state's chamber, the House is the people's chamber. And that we started going off of that when we did away with states electing the senators from their legislatures and made a direct election, and now we have two people's houses. So part of the restoration has to be through a repeal of the 17th.
Just a comment. A book I read on your recommendation, Larry, was Felix Morley's Federalism and Freedom, and he discusses the Electoral College fairly extensively. And up until about 1830, there were no popular elections in the United States for president. People think, well, we've always had presidential elections. No, we haven't. And the Constitution does not provide for a popular election of even electors. They're just appointed. So, you know, we've come into a situation, as you said, that benefits big cities. And, you know, they never come to Church Hill. You know, George Bush is not going to come to Church Hill, but he'll go to Nash Vegas and Memphis and those big places like that.
Hi, this is for Steve Wilkins, I believe. You had mentioned that the first step was to fill the pulpits, and that what we were doing would be based upon what we were learning. Beyond that, as everyday Christians, I'm struggling with what are practical ways that we can demonstrate our position in terms of who we are following, whether the state or our Lord Jesus. And I agree with, you know, in terms of all those principles and all of those issues of ownership and that we don't really own, and all the ways we've been tricked, in a sense, by the scheme of things into believing that we are free when we're actually slaves. How is it that we can today act or live as free men, and that would be demonstrated to all people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one thing is you do everything that you can do. For example, Larry's organization is by far the only organization you can support in regard to the gun issue and the rights issue. Now, is that he knows that his work in and of itself, that gun owners is not going to save America. He knows that the gospel is the answer. But you see, gun owners performs a very important function in defending us and keeping the wolves at bay until we can work on our houses and our churches and get things going. We have to have true reformation in our churches. Now that involves reformation in our families. So that means my children cannot be zombieized by the government school system. See, I can't have them in there. They've got to be able to think, they can't in that system. That's just all there is to it. So, and then you say, well, what about colleges? Well, the way things work nowadays, they have to have, until we can get the place where until we can show everybody that a college diploma is meaningless, you have to have a college diploma. So you have to get some kind of certification, and you jump through hoops. But hopefully our children by then are wise enough to see through the humanism there. But the point is, we've got to train our children properly, we've got to rule our houses well, and we've got to live with integrity. And I think that means being honest people and stating things and living as best we are able in this very corrupt situation, live consistently. And that's a very difficult problem. I confess it, because you're living in an empire that governs and has its fingers on everything. So there's no way I can't, in some manner or another, be giving illicit submission to an empire. From driver's license all the way through this voluntary tax system we have, all these things, in and of themselves, I think, are often illicit. But the empire, its tentacles are everywhere, and it's almost impossible to live with integrity now. But we have to do what we can, and in a sense, we're very much like the first century Christians in the Roman Empire. We have to try to do what we can to rebuild a culture that partakes of none of this stuff. And we teach our children why it's wrong, so that when their grandchildren come up, they can change everything around. If we haven't done it by then, Lord willing, they'll be able to do it then. But their structural change follows basic cultural change, and that cultural change must begin in our churches and our homes, and then it will change outwardly from there.